Well, I just wish that Karen had been here to hear that last lesson. I thank God that the truth has come out, you know. And it was just so powerful. I'm almost hesitant to speak. It'd be anticlimactic to what was said. It was just so wonderful. Maybe I can get a copy for Karen sometime of that. God made man because he loves stories. God made man because he loves stories. When I first read that years ago, I was troubled by it and was almost offended by it. And I started to tick off the reasons that I thought that God made man. And because I'm a little bit dim, it took a while for it to dawn on me that the old rabbi that came up with that adage understood that why God made man. It wasn't that, because he loved stories, but he wanted to make a point. He said that because he wanted to make a point that God must really value stories because his book is so full of them. The Bible teams or swarms with stories the way the oceans swarm and teem with all kinds of exotic life forms. The Bible has colorful characters, intriguing plots, captivating settings that stretch all the way from Ur of the Chaldees to Haran, down to Canaan, to Egypt, all the way back up to Syria, Assyria, Babylonia, across to Asia Minor, to Europe, to Rome. All these stories have these settings, and setting is just one of the three elements that every story must have. Must have a setting so that the characters and the action can have some place. So those are the three elements. You have characters, you have action, and you have settings. Another way of saying that, though, is this. Every story has someone who wants something but. Every story has someone or some people who want something but. And that but is, of course, the conflict, the problem that keeps the main character from getting what it is he or she wants. We call that the conflict, the problem. And there are two kinds of basic conflicts in every story. You've got external conflict, where you have David and Goliath, for example, fighting each other, or the Philistines and the Israelites fighting each other. And then you also have internal conflict, the one that I think is most interesting. And that's where the main character has to struggle to choose between two moral choices. And often the main character will make the wrong choice because of some character flaw in him. Like Abraham, as good a man as he was, he had some character flaw. He lied about his wife to Pharaoh and to Abimelech later on. Moses, that Rusty's talking to us about, he was a good man, but he wasn't perfect. He had his own problems. And then, of course, there was David and Peter. Even Peter, one of the apostles, he said at one time, I don't even know the man, he said, speaking of Christ. And he cursed, it says. And that word for curse is the word for anathema. He called anathema down on himself. That's a very serious thing. Well, speaking of these flawed characters, you have two major kinds of stories. You've got tragedies, and you have comedies. And by comedies, it is not meant something, a story that's funny or that has humor in it. That's not what a comedy is in literature. In a comedy, you have something like a U-shaped pattern. See if I've got one of these. Yeah. It looks like this, a comedy in literature. So that means that the main character starts out high. He's got a high status, like Joseph, who was the son of a very rich man, Jacob. And he had kind of a tragic character flaw, didn't he? He was a little bit braggadocious, wasn't he? Talked to his brothers, his family about the dreams he had and so on and so forth. And when he did that, then what happened? Then he falls, doesn't he? He falls so far down that he winds up in a prison in Egypt, sold as a slave. But because he's a good man and because God is with him, he begins this turn, doesn't he? And God stays with him, and finally he winds up just as high or higher than he was before. And so these stories that are what we call comedies have that pattern to it. The other kind of story is a tragedy. And with that kind of story, you start off with the main character, and he's usually up high somewhere, like King Saul. He's a king. Starts up high, but then he falls because of some character flaw. Remember that Saul, in comparison or in contrast to David, worshiped God only with part of his heart, where David sought the Lord with his whole heart, so that they comprise two foils against each other, two contrasts. And so Saul never did. He never did make that turn, did he? He never did go back up to where he was before. And so we would call him a tragic character, tragic figure. Another one like that would be, of course, Judas Iscariot. Judas Iscariot was an apostle of Christ himself. And yet he fell and he never recovered his status. So that brings us to one of the stories in the Bible that I want to which I want to apply all these things that I've been saying about stories. And I've chosen the second story in the Bible to do this, the story about Cain and Abel. But we're apt to miss a lot of the meaning in it if we don't understand the similarity between it and the first story of the Bible, the one with Adam and Eve. In both stories, someone wants something, but. In the first story, Eve looks at the tree. She sees that fruit. It's desirable. She wants it, but. And what a consequential but that proved to be. In the second story, Cain wants something, but. In both stories, God asks them a question. And in both stories, they give a sort of an answer. In both stories, God also asks them, "What is this that you have done? What have you done?" Showing the magnitude or enormity of the sin that they just did. In both stories, there's a curse. And in both stories, the characters are banished from their land. So after you think about the similarities between these two stories, you're made to wonder whether there's ever going to be this U-shaped pattern in the Bible with the whole story of mankind, or is there going to just be a tragic ending to the whole thing? As we look into one of these stories, with a tragic character, let's keep in mind now the difference between history and literature. History tells us what happened. History tells us what happened. Literature tells us what happens. And so when we put it that way, we're indicating that literature is concerned with universals, with what is universally true. So that when we read a story about different characters, we see ourselves in those characters, even in somebody like Cain. Okay, so literature is universal. And as we are reading this second story, considering this story, we want to be thinking about that. But remember what I've said now so far about stories. They deal with universal human experience, number one. Number two, they involve characters, setting, action. Number three, there's a character that wants something but. And finally, the characters will either be comedic or tragic. Okay, so let's take a look at Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4 and starting in verse 1. And I can't remember, is this going to be the New King James or
NAS?
Okay, so that's what I've got here. Okay, starting in verse 1 then, it says, Moses says, "Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain, and she said, 'I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord.'" Well, now, if you remember that just in the chapter before, God had cursed the serpent and said that the seed of the woman would crush your head. And so it makes you wonder whether when she had this child, she might have thought, well, here is the fulfillment of that curse. This is the seed. I'm the woman. This is the seed of me, and it's going to crush the head of that serpent. After all, what did that serpent do to me? What has he done to us? It's because of him that we're cast out of paradise. And verse 2. "Again, she gave birth to his brother, Abel. And Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground." Does this look like cavemen dragging their knuckles on the ground with a club over their shoulder and so on and so forth? No, it seems like they're very cultivated, they're very civilized and domesticated. Verse 3, "So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Abel, on his part also, brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard." Well, we can't tell for sure. There's nothing specified here about why the Lord did not have regard for Cain and his offering. But if you are a careful reader and you know that words are precious, and so you're very economic here with these words, that words are not wasted, especially in the Bible, that you could kind of glean an idea as to why probably the Lord was not pleased with Cain's offering. And you see there that there's a description of Abel's offering, which doesn't apply to Cain's. He says there that Abel brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat portions. Now, he didn't have to say that. Moses didn't have to put those details in there. But that he did kind of leans us into the direction that that's probably the reason that the Lord had regard for Abel's offering but not Cain's. Now that word for have regard for is a word for looking. It's not the regular word ra'ah, to look, but this is the word sha'ah, which means to look intently, to look at for a long time at something. And that's what the Lord did. When Abel brought his offering, he really looked intently at it. He had regard for it. And going on there, in that same verse there, the latter part, "So Cain became very angry, and his countenance, his face fell. Then the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. You must rule it." The word mashal means to rule. You must rule over it. Well, there are a few things I want to say about this passage here. First of all, I study a lot about Calvinism. To me, Calvinism is kind of like a leavening, a yeast. You know, it works insidious. You have to really watch out for it. the ESV Study Bible, for example, the Calvinists themselves will say that those notes in the ESV Study Bible are laced with Calvinism. And you know that one of the main points of Calvinism is that after the fall, that mankind became totally depraved. And involved in the total depravity of man is this loss of free will. Now, does it sound to you like Cain, that the Lord did or did not assume that Cain had free will? Doesn't it seem to you? Does it sound to you that he expected Cain to use his free will to do the right thing, to choose the right thing? It seems that way to me. So to me, this is a passage that is a spear in the side of Calvinism. There's another thing about this particular passage here that I want to bring out. And that is that if you remember the story about David and Saul, King Saul was always trying to kill David. He was pursuing him because he was afraid that he was going to take over his kingdom. So there was a time when David and his 600 men were in the area of En-Gedi. That's close to the Dead Sea. Karen and I visited Israel in 2008 in the summer. And she stayed on the bus. She was tired. It was hot outside. But I just had to go look at those caves there at En-Gedi. And I did. I got out and I looked up in the hills. And I could see cave after cave as I looked up there. And David, back in those days, was in one of them with his men. And they were probably back in the back of the cave. And here comes Saul as he was pursuing David. And he had to use the restroom. So he goes into the cave, and it describes how he took off his garment to use it. And as I'm telling this story to a prisoner in the county jail one time years ago, I trying to be discreet about it, I talked about how he took off his coat, and I said to Rick, I said, now what level of using the restroom do you think that he's referring to as he takes off his coat? And Rick raises his hand and he says, not what level, what number. So anyway, the men of David says to David, look, there's your enemy. He's right there. The Lord has delivered him into your hand according to the prophecy. So David takes his knife and he must have crept over to Saul, and instead of stabbing him and killing him, what he does is he takes his knife and he cuts a corner, a piece of Saul's garment off. And then Saul finishes and he puts his garment back on. He's completely oblivious to David, and he goes out of the cave and he goes some distance, and then out comes David and he calls out to Saul. And he lets him know. He says, look, the Lord delivered you into my hand. I could have killed you. Look here. Here's a piece of your garment right here. I am not after you. I'm not trying to take over your kingdom. You have to believe me. And he did for a while. The point of this, the reason I'm bringing this up, is to provide a contrast with Cain. David also had a choice. He had a choice, and he chose to do the right thing. He did not want to lay his hand on the Lord's anointed. And, you know, I think about myself a lot of times, how often it was that I was in a situation where I had an opportunity to take revenge on somebody. And boy, I was going to. I was going to say something back to them, or I was going to do something to them. But because there was time, I had some time to think and process what I was doing, I was able to talk myself out of it, thinking that revenge is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. So I always thought about that. Leave it up to the Lord to do that. not saying that because I'm good at doing that or that I'm an example, because I have failed sometimes. But the last thing I want to say about this particular passage is about the personification of sin itself here in this passage. The Lord says, "And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it." Isn't that interesting? Sin isn't a thing. It doesn't crouch. It's an idea. It's a concept. It's an abstraction. But Moses, because of the inspiration, personifies. He treats it like a person, or maybe some scholars say a beast, like a lion or something crouching at the door. I would rather say that it's more like a serpent, because that's the context in chapter 3, where the serpent was involved, or a demon or something like that. Some scholars say that. Well, this idea of the personification of sin will be taken up again in Romans chapter 6, where Paul will personify sin in this kind of way. Well, moving on then to verse 8 then. Make sure I'm in the right spot here. Yes. In the New American Standard Bible, it says it this way. Cain told Abel his brother. Period. Cain told Abel his brother. And then there's a period there. It seems like there's some words missing. And I think that there are. I think that somewhere in the Hebrew manuscript, some words were lost or something. And I'm not the only one. For one thing, that verb there doesn't go right. It amer doesn't go there. I would rather have another verb, deber, or something like that. Well, the Greek translation of this passage also indicates that there's some words missing. It says, it adds the words, it says, he invited him into the field. Cain told Abel, his brother, let's go into the field. Something like that is the Septuagint, the Greek translation. All, according to the scholars, this isn't me, I don't have access to all of these resources, but the scholars say that all of the ancient versions also say that he invited him into the field. And then going on, and it came about, now I'm saying that because I'm going to come back to that. And it came about when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? And he said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? Now when he used that word, my brother's keeper, he's taking a dig, I believe, at the Lord God, because Abel was the keeper. He was the keeper of sheep. And God favored Abel's offering and did not look with regard at Cain's. So when he uses that language, I think he's trying to get back at God in resentment. Verse 10, he said, God says, what have you done? What have you done? Showing just how bad it was, the thing that Cain did to his own brother. The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. Now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. You will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is too great to bear. Behold, you have driven me this day from the face of the ground, and from your face I will be hidden, and I will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. Well, it's ironic, isn't it, that the brother who made his living off the ground, off the earth, is now alienated from it. And so verse 15, so the Lord said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain so that no one finding him would slay him. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Well, some scholars say that Cain was not a tragic figure, because God showed mercy on him in letting him live and putting a mark on him so that people wouldn't kill him or beasts wouldn't kill him. But the Apostle John says otherwise. If you look over at 1 John chapter 3, verses 11 and 12, this is what an apostle himself has to say about Cain. He says, "For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the wicked one, of the evil one," that word poneros for those of you who take Greek, "who was of the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brother's were righteous." Remember, I referenced there at the very beginning of Genesis 4, how that it may have been that when Eve had Cain, and she thought to herself, maybe this is the seed. This is the seed that was promised that would crush the head of that serpent. But remember what God also said in Genesis 3:15. He says, "Enmity I place between you," speaking to the serpent, "between you and the woman, between her seed and your seed." The serpent has seed, doesn't he? He has offspring. He has people. And here's one of them, according to John. So these scholars, these commentators are wrong about Cain. He was a tragic figure, and he didn't recover. How universal is this story about Cain and Abel? Well, I can tell you from my own experience, because I have experienced something like this. I'm going to personalize this. When I was just 7 years old, living in Central Texas on a dairy farm with my family, I took a lot of pride in how fast I could run. Nobody in the first grade could outrun me, and that meant a whole lot to me. Then one day at school, this boy by the name of Donald Proctor, a second grader, but he wasn't that much older than I was, a few months older than I was, he and I raced, and he beat me. And like Cain, I invited him over to an area of the playground where nobody was. No teachers were there, no children were there, and I invited him over to the seesaws. So we started seesawing, going up and down, and just as I was sitting down on the ground and he was up high, I bucked that board. I bucked that thing, and I made Arnold Proctor release his grip of that little iron thing in front that you're holding on to, throw his arms out, try to catch himself before he hit the ground. And in the process of doing that, he stabbed his right eye, his eye, with his thumb. And the tears started coming down his face. And I got off the seesaw and I sidled up to him while the tears were coming down. And he wasn't crying. I was noticed. He didn't cry. And more important than that was that he wasn't blaming me. He didn't accuse me of doing anything. He just said, I poked my eye, as though I had nothing to do with it. And as he turned to walk away, I had these thoughts in my mind, and I still remember this. I thought, not only is he faster than I am, but he's a better person than I am. What have I done? As he walked away, my eyes fell on his feet, expecting tennis shoes, light shoes, athletic shoes like I was wearing. And what I saw was these big old farm boy clodhoppers. And just to show you how much I believe in the universality of good literature and its relevance to our lives, I was planning on telling you about this, the first novel I ever taught as an English teacher in Tucson, It was called A Separate Piece by John Knowles. And in that story, I don't have time for that now, but in that story, it's very similar to what I went through, what I experienced, and what Cain and Abel went through. It's a story about two best friends during World War II in America. And one of them was very athletic, and the other just had to be the best scholar. And Gene, the best scholar, began to have this dark, wild, irrational suspicion that Finney was trying to ruin his grades. So as they were climbing this tree one day to jump from this limb into the river, it's very scary, very high up, and Finney goes out on the limb at first to jump from it, Gene, with all these dark thoughts and these wild impulses, just like Cain, just like me, he jounced that limb. He jounced that limb and caused Finney, who never loses his balance, he's like a Greek god. He was harmony in motion, the text tells us. But this time he lost his balance, and just as he was falling, he turned and looked at Gene in his face, and he saw something there that he had never seen before. Well, he fell and he hit the ground with a sickening thud, it says. He didn't die on that day. He shattered his leg. He'd never play sports again. But later on, he did die. And it is a story that is worth your time. You can watch it. I just watched it just last week. You can get it on YouTube or somewhere online. And it's very close to the book. It takes about 2 hours. Well, let me finish up by talking about what people thought in the Middle Ages. In medieval time, the people recognized that humans had this deeply polarized nature. On the one hand, the Lord God had formed man from the earth, and so he was earthy. And no matter how hard he might try, he could never really escape that earthy element in him. On the other hand, the Lord God also breathed into Adam his own breath, and he became a living soul, an offspring from God himself. And so these people in the Middle Ages tried to represent these two opposite sides of man in their architecture. On the top of their cathedrals, they erected a steeple or a spire that pointed up to heaven, up to God himself, inspiring them in their worship services to reach up to heaven, as it was their very nature to do. And that was a good thing. On the other hand, they also put a gargoyle up on the side of the building. And this gargoyle served a couple of purposes. It was kind of like a rain gutter, and the water would rush through the mouths of these gargoyles. But these gargoyles were carved. They were constructed in a way to make them look hideous, almost scary. But the purpose of these gargoyles was not to scare people. It was to mock them. It was to ridicule them, to tell them as they come into this holy place, "How dare you come in here? You're nothing but dirt. You're made of dirt, and to dirt you're going to return. You don't belong here." And there's some truth to that. Just as there's truth in the spire, there's also truth in these gargoyles, because we are earthy, and no matter what we do, we will never escape that earthiness that we have, while we're on this earth anyway. But we're more than just earth. We also have this divine, transcendent nature in us. And there's so many times when I come to the assembly, I feel rather gargoylish when I enter the assembly. I feel earthy. But when I leave, I feel more transcendent. I feel lifted up. And isn't that really one of the main reasons we come here, is to inspire each other and encourage each other. So what is it then that I would like for you to take away from all that I've said about the stories, and especially about the story about Cain and Abel? Well, mainly this. When sin is crouching at the door of your soul, and its desire is to have you and to rule over you, then do what Paul advised you to do in Colossians chapter 1, verse 3 and Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. Here's what Paul said. If then you are raised with Christ. Now, remember in chapter 2, he was talking about being raised with Christ through baptism. And you've been baptized, you've been raised with Christ. So he says, if then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. And one of the ways you can get your minds off the things of the earth, off envy, off revenge, off hatred and lust and suspicion and all those dark things that tend to drag you down to the earth, is by remembering some of the delightful, captivating stories that God has reserved for you in His book. Those stories are not only captivating, but they truly are life-saving, if you'll just get into them. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Now we have a song.